From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
This is Digital Campus, episode 61, recorded October 15th, 2010. Fantastic Four. Well, welcome to another edition of Digital Campus from the Center for History and New Media. I'm Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org, coming to you today from a Barnes & Noble cafe somewhere outside of Hartford. Doing the commute, the faculty commute this semester. It's pretty miserable. But so if you hear any
reporting from the,
on location, actually, right, from a major book retailer. We're going to talk about the publishing industry. So if you hear any coffee grinding in the background or kids running around, that's what it is. But I'm here today with Dan Cohen. That's Dan, I think you just heard from dancohen.org. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Tom.
And our other regular, Mills Kelly from edwire.org. Hi, Mills.
How are you, Tom?
Good. And actually, we have some big news to announce today. We are promoting one of our irregulars to regular status. I don't know how much of a promotion that is. But we're very happy to welcome Amanda French, who you've all heard many times from AmandaFrench.net, to the show as one of our regular hosts. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Tom. I'm looking forward to the increase in salary.
Yeah, you should see the benefits
aren't
package.
We all?
You have to go through the hazing first.
Okay.
And we'll do that later on in the show. But let's jump in. A lot to talk about this week, actually. And one of the things we noticed was the press release from Amazon, which is increasingly making waves in the publishing industry. I shouldn't be saying this from Barnes & Noble, but Amazon is set to launch something called Kindle Singles, which are essentially a pamphlet series. They're going to publish pieces of written works of between 10 and 30,000 words under a Kindle Singles brand, and then make them available as ebooks. I know, Dan, you've been thinking about this idea of pamphlets and how ebooks could revive that format that has a very long tradition in the publishing industry, but has in the last 50 or 100 years really fallen by the wayside. What do you think of this Kindle Singles announcement?
Well, I think, and I'm going to compress all of my normal 50 minutes of ranting into 10 minutes because I'm going to have to leave, unfortunately, a bit early on the podcast today. And so my rant for today is, you know, why is Amazon the innovator? I mean, like, why aren't university presses thinking about maybe doing, you know, $9.99 80-page books or long essays? You know, I just think it's an interesting and sort of sad statement about the state of publishing that there's this, you know, large .com that's, I think, doing more innovative things in e-publishing than really should be going on. I was talking kind of off the record to some people this morning who were interviewing me about the future of publishing and specifically about, you know, the future of the book, which in their mind they equated with, you know, somehow taking the book as it is right now and just sort of like sticking it online with like a little bit of window dressing around it. And I was really trying to say that, you know, there has to be experimentation in form and in economic models. I still don't get why there haven't been, you know, hasn't been a university press program to have, let's say, $99 a year, all you can eat, all you can read, books from, you know, whatever, Harvard University Press on your Kindle, or at least just making some kind of moves to try out different models, different sizes, shapes, payment schemes. And so, you know, I've just really been depressed by the rate of innovation in this area compared to, say, in journalism, where I think there's just Armageddon going on. And so people have had to try all kinds of different models, many of which will be unsuccessful. And I think we've discussed that on the podcast before. But this seems like a no-brainer for me. I think when this came out, I tweeted that I thought it was a genre that was really well-suited for the Academy because, frankly, there are a lot of dissertations that don't need to be 250-page books or 300-page books. They're probably – they'd be a solid 80-page read or maybe an 80-page read with an online exhibit to go with it, let's say if it's an art history book. So I think once we're liberated from – you know, the kind of print and purchasing requirements of the monograph, of the 200 or 300-page, $60 or $80 or $100 print book, why not try something in that range of the 30,000-word, you know, report? I just think it makes a lot of sense to try to experiment with form, and with pricing. And, you know, I say kudos to Amazon for beating out, I think, some other potential innovators in this space.
You know, I think it's you said, Dan, that it's very well suited to academic writing, and I think that's absolutely right. I also think it's, to me, my feeling is it's very well suited to electronic writing. I know that a lot of the kind of, if you took what I've written on my blog over the past, I don't know, you know, couple of years, you know, there are some, I think, some themes there, some things that could be stitched together and put into a longer form, but it's probably not 100,000 words. It's probably more like 30,000 words. I think it's the way we kind of, that's the length at which we tend to express ideas online, I think. And so I think Amazon's probably tapping into something there. Mills, Amanda, do you guys think you're going to be publishing a Kindle single anytime soon?
Well, I don't know that I'll be publishing a Kindle single, but just because I don't know that Amazon would be interested in the things that I might publish. But, you know, just when you said this about things from your blog, it occurred to me, you know, some of the most read and reread posts from Ed Wired over the last few years was a three-part series I did on making digital scholarship count. And if you took those three plus all of the comments from readers, it probably adds up to about 25,000 words. And, you know, and it was a snapshot of where we were in our thinking about it at that particular moment. And so now it's kind of out of date, but something like that could certainly be published. The other thing I was thinking, as Dan was talking about this, is something that's kind of disappeared from the scholarly publishing landscape is the working paper series. You know, these used to be common, and they were a place where scholars could try out a rough idea, but something that was not so rough that it didn't deserve to be published and disseminated. And so, you know, and they were often printed between two pieces of heavy construction paper rather than bound, but they were still working papers and they circulated knowledge among scholars. And, you know, that's kind of moved off to the internet in a way, but that's something, they had a coherence and they had a purpose. And so as they're about that same size, that sort of 20 to 35,000 word piece.
Yeah, I think this is interesting. One of the interesting things I think about it is what Amazon's motivation might be for doing this. And I think that their motivation for doing it is probably to take a little end run around the publishers that it's been having trouble with. Because, Dan, you were saying, well, why don't university presses do this? But book publishers in general, I think, have been conservative when it comes to innovating in this space, and Amazon is just the giant gorilla, you know. And so there was a whole controversy not too long ago, or not controversy, but sort of argument between Amazon and publishers, where Amazon wants to offer ebooks for cheap, which, you know, seems logical because there's a lot less overhead, but publishers want to make sure that the prices are high. So, you know, Amazon put this little passive-aggressive notice on a lot of its Kindle books saying, this price was set by the publisher. You know, it's not our fault if this ebook is $14.99 instead of, you know, $5.99 or $8.99. So almost all Kindle books have that. So in thinking why Amazon would want to do this, I really think that they want to do this because they want ebooks to be cheap. And I want ebooks to be cheap. I want to buy lots of ebooks and to buy them cheaply. And, you know, it's interesting when you're talking about mini ebooks, because length doesn't really matter in the digital world. I mean, there's no difference between a 90-page book and a, you know, 290-page book in terms of what it costs to manufacture and distribute in the ebook world. So the only reason I can think of is that this is, you know, Amazon sort of thinks that this is a way to offer cheap ebooks to, you know, and show traditional publishers, you know, that they're not going to be ruled by what the traditional publishers think is the right price for ebooks.
Yeah, and in fact, with Kindle books, right, there are no page numbers even. So there really is no difference in the experience in reading a long form work or a short form work. And I think you're right, Amanda. I think they're definitely taking a shot at the publishing industry. One of the things that the vice president of Kindle Content, Russ Grandinetti, said in the press release was, ideas and the words to deliver them should be crafted to their natural length, not to an artificial marketing length that justifies a particular price. So they definitely are taking a shot at the publishing industry.
Great statement. I mean, it's totally true.
You're totally right.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember these in the 90s. Was it Penguin that had these? They were 60 pence in the UK, I remember where they started. But then I think they did come to the United States, and they were maybe $1 or $1.99. But these little books, do you remember them? They were even smaller than the Octavo size, like half that. I don't know what that would
sure.
be.
Sure, yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
yeah, duodecimal. Yeah, yeah, right. So they it was exactly that. They were, you know, I remember the first one that I bought was an essay by Montaigne. And it was like the perfect size. It was 60 pages. It was $1. It had a little bit of an introduction. It was just perfect. And you could slip it in your pocket. It just made a lot of sense to me. And I think they sold tons of those, didn't
yeah.
they? I mean, and I think they probably could upsell from that to, you know, something larger.
So I wonder if it's something like, you know, they're doing these short ebooks because it's the kind of thing that print publishers don't publish. Because it's not worth it, you know, financially. Like maybe the scale of publishing, you know, 5,000 90-page books isn't worth it or something. Or they can't charge $25.95 for a 90-page book or something, so they don't publish any of those. I wonder if it's
yeah. Funny. I'd love to learn more about the economics of all this, but I think in terms of the content, I'm willing to trust Montaigne that if 30,000 words is long enough to make a point, then 30,000 words is long enough to make a point. I'm gonna.
Well, isn't it also that, you know, you go into whatever your Costco, which is really, you know, has become one of these big locations for purchasing books, and you know, you see that biography of John Adams, and you think, oh man, you know, that has got to be worth $30. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a doorstop, and you know, I think size has been this strange signal for price, even though it's theoretically it shouldn't have anything to do with it, right?
Well, it does to an extent. I was actually really shocked when I was trying to publish my dissertation and was getting advice from various people, because, you know, as a graduate student, I was really idealistic and I was trying to make, you know, do the best work I could and make sure it was right. But at the same time, I was writing to a specific page limit, you know, which was in that, you know, 250 to 300 page, you know, recommendation that the College of Arts and Sciences had for graduate students. And yet when I was talking to publishers, you know, on like how to get published by a university press, they were like, short. Have a short book.
Yeah, nice and short.
Yeah. Make sure it's short. I'm like, really?
Hey, well, folks, looks I'm like... sorry. I need to head out, but it's good talking with you.
Looking all right, Dan. Dan, we'll talk to you next time.
Okay,
well, that's a good point to move on. We can take a look at what's going on in EDUCAUSE. EDUCAUSE is going on this week, and I think there's been a steady stream of interesting news out of that meeting. Does anybody know where EDUCAUSE is this year? Where is this?
I never go, so I don't
know. Yeah, I'm not sure. Anyway, there has
but
been quite a bit of...
it doesn't matter in the digital world.
Right. It actually, it totally doesn't matter. And, you know, the big news that that came out on the, I think, the first day of the conference on Monday, was that the Gates Foundation announced a $20 million new program for education technology. And they're looking at making education technology reach more students and to improve the learning outcomes from educational technology. Now, they're giving these grants in a couple of different categories, four actually. One is open courseware. Another is blended learning, which I think means kind of mixed classroom, online kinds of experiences. Deeper learning, which is, I think, code for sort of virtual worlds and games. And then learner analytics, which I think is innovations in assessment and in identifying students that can benefit from these technologies and that sort of thing. This is really the first time I think we've seen Gates get into post-secondary educational technology in a big way, in a way that like someone like the Center for History and New Media could apply for a grant from them. We haven't seen a kind of open call for proposals from Gates in our world. What do people make of this, Amanda? What are your thoughts on this big Gates announcement?
Well, it's only natural to compare it to the story we talked about last time with Mark Zuckerberg donating whatever it was, $100 million directly to the Newark school system. And so actually, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about, number one, it makes me mad that our national public education system is some kind of charity that people have to keep giving money to. I mean, isn't this a basic qualification for a citizen? Isn't it a basic requirement in our country? How come we can't fund it out of government money? But, you know, I'm over it. It's okay. So it's fine. It's being supported by, you know, great philanthropists. That's a good thing. But apart from that, you know, I was sort of thinking about different models of, you know, investing in K-12 public education in this country. And it's like, oh, do you want to give the money directly to the school district? Or do you want to do this kind of thing, which is a bit more removed? You know, funding grant programs for people to build various kinds of software. And it's, you know, it's interesting that Bill Gates would take the latter approach and Mark Zuckerberg would take the former approach. But, you know, and then the only other thing to be said about it is, you know, sounds cool. I bet some good technology will come out of this.
Mills, any thoughts on this?
Yeah. First of all, I think it's also worth mentioning that this is really, the $20 million goes along with a like $34 or $35 million grant to community colleges, or a program to That's provide right. grants to community colleges to improve success rates in community college education. And so I think it's really, if you see it in that context, then it's especially wise giving, because these two things I think really go hand in hand, is improving improving success in community college is going to be affected by some of the kinds of things that this $20 million grant is going to fund. And if you read the description of the things that they're expecting to fund, it's clear that it's a big part of it is targeting student success. So I think that's really great, because excuse me, some of the more significant grants in higher ed from philanthropists of late have been focused much more, or foundations have been focused much more on access. And it's not that I think access isn't a worthy goal. I think it's something really important to be funding, but access is not the same thing as success. And so I'm really pleased with this announcement, these sort of two announcements together, because they are focused in a lot of ways on success. I think some people are going to be rubbed a little bit the wrong way by one of the statements in the press release about essentially coming up with new ways to, how do they say it, helping institutions, instructors, and students benefit from learning analytics, which can monitor student progress in real time and customize proven supports and interventions, which I think if you're inclined to worry about surveillance of your teaching, then you're going to get a little freaky about that. But I'm actually not one of those people that worries about that. I think the more open our classrooms are to observation by people from outside, the better. I think I've been advocating open teaching since the beginning of my career. So I think it's when classrooms are closed off from observation that all kinds of weird things happen that are not necessarily positive. It makes it too easy to kind of slack your way through the class as an instructor or a student. So I'm not a big believer in surveillance, but at the same time, I am a believer in open classrooms. So I think the whole thing is really exciting, and I'm glad that there is money for post-secondary education, not just primary and secondary ed. And I think some really exciting stuff is going to come out of this. So
It is going to be something to watch. I mean, I think this really has, I don't know whether the results of the program will be any good or not. I think that remains to be seen. We'll see. But I do think that one thing's for sure, this is going to change the landscape of, you know, our fields, educational technology, digital humanities. All of a sudden there's this new player. Gates suggested that he might give as much as $80 million over the next 4 years to this. All of a sudden, you know, Gates is one of the biggest players, just like that, in funding the kinds of things we're involved in. So right up there with MacArthur and Mellon, NEH and the Department of Ed, and those usual suspects. Now we've got Gates. And so, I think we're really going to see some changes that will have effects. And I think it'll be interesting to see.
Can I just say two other things about this, sort of one positive and one a little less positive? On the positive side, the thing that has bugged me for years about the MacArthur funding is that it seems to derive from a belief that gaming is the future of education. And that somehow, you know, we can learn, and I think that we can learn a lot from the gaming industry, and in terms of sort of immersive experiences and how that can affect student learning. But the MacArthur funding is always seemed to me a little myopic in that sense. And the Gates announcement mentions some things about that, but on the positive side, I do really think that it's nice to see that the funding is spread across a whole variety of areas and is going to leave a lot of room, I think, for innovation by educators. And so I'm really pleased about that. On the slightly less positive side, I think there may be a kind of underlying assumption in this this approach that distance education in some way is the future of higher education, or they talk about blended learning and, you know, a mixture of face-to-face and online. Well, that's fine, and I think that's great, but I've said before on the podcast, you know, so a lot of people in higher education think that distance learning is it's like the cold fusion. You know, as cold fusion is and always will be the energy source of the future, I think distance ed is and always will be the solution to all financial problems in higher education. And it's just not going to happen. And so I think it will be important. I don't think it's going to be the solution that a lot of people think it is. So I would hate to see, you know, when the announcement of who gets the money comes out, that everything's focused on distance ed. That would really disappoint me.
Yeah, and I think we have seen that Bill Gates personally, not the Gates Foundation necessarily, but Bill Gates personally shares that view. I think we saw a couple of weeks ago he made some statements about the future of education, and that distance learning would be the, you know, distance learning programs could be the new Harvard and Yale of higher ed. And I think, you know, there's definitely a connection between those two, this announcement and those statements. Regarding your first point, Mills, I think that brings us nicely to another story coming out of EDUCAUSE, which is some worry about Second Life, and
surprise,
that
surprise, surprise.
This is the where we gloat a little bit. It seems that there's been a bit of a mass migration from Second Life when Second Life announced the end of their educational discounts, and campus that have gotten heavily involved in Second Life are worrying about what to do next with their virtual campuses. Mills, I know what your thought about this is. Your thought is I told you so.
That kind of sums it up for me. I hope that when we put this, you know, when we actually put this together for broadcast, we'll be able to just pipe back in what I said, however long ago it was.
We do have that flashback music that we haven't used in a while. Maybe we'll right. We could slot that in right here.
You know, Tom, I think it was. It may have been you, it may have been Mills, who I remember really remarking on it when you made the point that data in Second Life is not exportable. You know, I don't know how people are doing this mass migration. It's a great visual image. You know, you picture people trudging along with their knapsacks, you know.
Knapsacks full of pickles.
That's right.
Like a wagon train from Second Life.
But I remember being kind of, you know, skeptical about Second Life and kind of eye-rolling about it and not really having a good reason for that eye-rolling until you mentioned that, you know. So it was, it's been a stone that I've thrown at Second Life ever since. Well, you can't get your data out of there. It's proprietary, so...
Well, we really should get someone on here who can defend virtual campuses and virtual worlds, because I think we're all skeptics. But I do think you know, this announcement, the proprietary nature of Second Life, the difficulty of getting out, the lack of alternatives, does suggest that maybe we were a little bit right in all that name calling. More news coming out of EDUCAUSE. There's a new recommendation engine for students called Sherpa. Amanda, you brought this up. What do you think about Sherpa?
You know, I haven't seen, you know, I didn't see the demo or anything. I just have been reading a little bit about it. So of course, the proof is going to be in the pudding about like what this software actually is and what it actually does. But there was a demo of a product called Sherpa, or maybe it wasn't even a demo, just sort of a description, that is supposed to, like Netflix, recommend things for students, recommend courses, recommend library resources, all that kind of thing, gathering data from I think Blackboard in particular, but other university resources as well. You know, Blackboard, you know, you really, you know, if you have been in college for a while and you've been using Blackboard or some kind of learning management system like that, it does collect a lot of information about what classes you've had and so forth, but it doesn't really do anything with that information. So so this system is supposed to do some recommending to students. And I think that can only be a good thing if it does work really well. But when I worked at NC State Libraries, they had developed something that was sort of similar to that. They did a lot of data mining, not so much based on an individual student's profile, but based on a course. You know, they looked at the course catalog and took keywords from course descriptions and built recommendations of library resources and things like that for those courses. So I think we're generating so much data these days. I think it can only be a good thing to try to use that data in productive ways.
What I'd like to see, I haven't taken a close look at any of this, but I hope they're not just using data from Blackboard and the university kind of IT infrastructure about these students, because the worry there is that, you know, you don't really get an accurate picture of a student's interests from what they've posted on Blackboard and what they've, you know, and the information that's logged about them in the university systems. I think, you know, it would be great to see if they could actually integrate data to the extent that that's possible from Amazon, from Facebook, from Netflix, to get a better view of the student as a you know, rounded person. And you know, it may be if they could take information from those systems, you might actually get a recommendation engine that would point students to educational resources and, you know, primary source documents, books, courses, other things that really did match their interests. I think one of the problems a lot of students had, I know I had as an undergraduate, it's hard to really match what the college has to offer with the things that you are actually interested in. You know, had chosen a different major had I realized some of the cool things that were going on in let's say anthropology, or some of the cool things that were going on in some of the science departments. I didn't, because I didn't think I was interested in those things. In fact, I was interested in those things. And if somebody had taken a look at my movie choices, the books I was reading for pleasure, the kinds of magazines I subscribed to, they might have been able to tell me that. But you wouldn't have been able to tell that from the courses I was actually taking. I think that these kinds of systems do hold out a lot of promise, but I hope that they take the whole student into account in building these profiles and recommendations.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking, first of all, this seems to me like a nice add-on to Zotero. It takes a look at what you've saved in your library and the libraries of the people who you might be following on Zotero, and then says to you, have you ever thought about this? And so that could be, you know, that could be quite interesting. And in particular, you know, the thing that we're losing rapidly as fewer and fewer people go into the library, the physical library, is that serendipitous experience of just kind of walking down the aisle looking for that book with the call number that you need, and then you pull that book and then you happen to notice the book right next to it, or you know, one shelf below, has this title that catches your eye, and you know, it may be in a whole different call number sequence than what you would have looked for, so you never would have turned it up in a Google search, but it happens to be shelved next to the thing that you were pulling. And there's some Library of Congress reason why they're shelved near each other. And so so you find something that you never would have encountered otherwise. And so this is, to me, the attractive thing to these recommendation systems is that they do recommend things that wouldn't have occurred to you. And so I can imagine, you know, scanning through the reading list subscribed or assigned by individual faculty members and then doing just what Tom said, recommending a course that, you know, you took courses where you read these books, well, and these articles, well, here's a course that is in some way connected to that.
I remember once seeing a presentation by Patrick Murray-John at the University of Mary Washington, where he's really into linked data, semantic data, and he made this point that I just have remembered ever since then, where he says, you know, the only entity on campus that knows which courses are assigning the same book is the university bookstore. And they don't let, you know, that information is closed down in their little, you know, Oracle database or whatever it is. You know, they don't share that information. Nobody can generally find that out. So if a chemistry class is reading Frankenstein and a literature class is reading Frankenstein, they're never going to know about it. And, you know, you lose the opportunity for a lot of great conversations that way. And so I don't know how much I'm into this whole, you know, gathering data about the student from various different services they already use, like Amazon and Netflix and whatever. I think there's privacy concerns with that, and it just seems sort of technically difficult in some cases. But definitely, like, things that are all within the university, I think, could be talking to each other a lot better than they do. We could be making connections much better than we do. So if this helps with that, I'm all for it.
But it would also be interesting to know what percentage of our students use Rhapsody or Pandora or use the Genius settings on their iTunes account. So to see, you know, are they already opting into these recommendation software systems?
Yeah.
And if it was set up as an opt-in, then I think that would probably be a better choice.
Yeah. And I mean, certainly there are huge technical difficulties too. I mean, the privacy concerns are real. The technical difficulties are possibly insurmountable, but I guess my point is that I just how much can you really tell about a student from what he or she says on Blackboard? I mean, it seems to me that that is the time when the student is being least his or her true self. You know, I mean, it's like,
right,
it's, you know, they're interacting with their professor. That's like, that's not the real person. So I just wonder how much real information you can get from that student. You know, maybe some, you know, for some students it's bound to work better than others, but you know, the way that, you know, at least in my experience, the way a lot of students interact with even, you know, even a course blog is, you know, in the most kind of bland way. You know, it's they're doing an assignment, they're doing it because they need to get the grade, and I guess it's just like garbage in, garbage out. You know, I just don't know how much we're going to be able to tell from those interactions. But you know what, I think this is an exciting announcement. I think there's a lot of research to be done in this area, and we'll see. Moving on, we've got a couple more things to get through today. Another big announcement this week. The NHPRC, the National Historical Publications and Records Commission, the National Archives essentially, and the University of Virginia announced that they are making the papers of the founding fathers available for free online. UVA has been digitizing and creating edited edited volumes of the Founding Fathers' papers for years, and at least for the last 10 or 15 years, putting those online, but in a gated subscription way. And this new grant from NHPRC is going to enable UVA to make that stuff available for free to everyone. Mills, you know, this seems like something that we should all be very happy with. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong. And you know, it is certainly, I think, a good example of why there have to be these public-private or public, you know, federal and state partnerships over these kinds of things, because we all know that the digitization of all of this material is extraordinarily expensive to do if you're going to do it first, if you're going to do it, and even more expensive if you're going to do it right. And so it's too much to ask any university or organization to digitize all this material and then make it available for free without some support for that, because it's not just getting it digitized, it's then once it's up, keeping it up and keeping the links unbroken and all of that kind of stuff that has to happen to projects once the initial work is done. So I think this is really great. And, you know, what could be more important for a democracy than access to crucial papers like these, and free and open access? Because it's bothered me for years that UVA has kept these in a subscription only system, because everybody in the United States and needs to have the possibility of access. They don't need to read it, but they need to have the possibility of access to this, in the same way that, you know, we've screamed and yelled on the podcast about, you know, Reed Elsevier locking up federally funded medical research, for instance. It's crazy that it's locked away. Now, I understand why UVA did it, because they had to recover costs for this extraordinary effort. So I'm very happy about that. I will say it will probably kill off one of my favorite whipping boy websites, which is the website of the Constitution Society, which is it's a fantastic database of all the documents, primary source documents underlying the creation of the American Constitution, and not just American documents, but also those from Great Britain and some from France translated into English. And it's really a great the interface is horrible, but the database of the material that's there is really great. The reason it's one of my favorite whipping boy websites is because it's not possible to learn who is behind the Constitution. It's constitution.org. It's not possible to learn who's behind it, because let me tell you, I've tried and I'm pretty good at that. But I have learned that same web hosting service on the other sort of behind the screen is also providing web hosting to various militia organizations around the United States, and so who have a very strong interest in constitutional documents. And so this is why this database exists. And so now, once UVA puts all this stuff up, maybe there won't be a need for the constitution.org site anymore, and I'll have to find some other website to whip on. There's always the Hitler Historical Museum.
Yeah, I think, you know, it can. I'm not looking forward to increased ammunition for the endless debates about what the founders meant, but otherwise, I'm with you, Mills. I think this is a very good thing.
But at least the possibility of reference to the actual source will now exist.
Right, right. Have you used these papers before through the subscription, Mills or Tom?
I haven't. I mean, I've poked around the Rotunda website and looked at the interface for, you know, sort of other reasons, for interface reasons and because of our Papers of the War Department project, to see how other people are doing it. But I haven't actually used the documents in my work.
Because I was just wondering if they're marked up in TEI or what. I bet they are.
Yeah, they are, right.
They're very heavy, you know, that costs a lot of money to do that. And yeah, it makes them much more useful than just a scan with dirty OCR behind it. But it is a lot of investment to...
Well, I'm just glad that they're going to be public, and that it seems like the National Archives, under its new leadership, looks like it's starting to insist and actually not just insist but make available funding to make its projects, the projects that it funds, fully free and open access. I think that they should have been doing that all along. You know, this isn't the first federal funding that the Washington Papers or the Jefferson Papers and the Madison Papers have received. And in the past, it wasn't a mandate of the federal funding to make that information freely available. I'm glad to see that maybe the archives is starting to move in that direction. So I think that's a good thing. That's the mandate is good, and the additional funding so that it's not an unfunded mandate is good. So I think we're seeing the start of something new and something good. From the wider tech world, we saw some news this week too. Some news that I think will have implications for campus life and certainly for museums and cultural heritage institutions. We saw the launch of Windows Phone 7, Microsoft's new mobile operating system, and the announcement of a whole bunch of handsets from a bunch of different handset makers, Samsung and HTC, and LG and others, and the announcement that Windows Phone is going to be on several carriers as well. What do people think about? Have people had a chance to look at the Windows Phone demos? And what do people think about Microsoft's new entry into the smartphone business?
I haven't looked at it too much, but I've heard people talking about it who have looked at it. So, you know, secondhand or third-hand reporting.
We're all about that here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's the most unscholarly reportage ever. What I've heard was that people were really impressed with the range of phones, so that there are some that have physical keyboards, there are some that are touchscreen, there are on all kinds of carriers, and that the interface is really good, you know. So it seems like a really strong contender in the mobile space.
Well, Mills, you've been in the market for a smartphone. Have you gotten
one? I have finally ditched my crappy old clamshell phone, much to the relief of my 13-year-old son, who is no longer embarrassed by my phone because I now have an Android, which I'm
very nice.
I'm very happy with. Okay. I held out as long as it was possible to hold out. You'll be glad to know, however, that I have not tweeted once from my new phone.
Good.
There are some things.
Even though the app is built in, right? It's built
you know, in it doesn't seem screen. To be built into my.
And you're not sure which model you have, are you?
I don't even know that. I just know. Yeah. I know that I have an Android phone, and it has lots of icons on it, and I can. It took me, I will say though, it took me about 5 minutes to figure out how to answer it the first time it rang. But I am in fact old. I'll be even older on Monday. So, but at least I've made it into the 2000s or the 21st century or whatever century we're in. On the question of Microsoft, I guess I'm surprised it took so long, but it's. I think it's going to be ultimately important just because Microsoft really has really improved Windows a lot. I mean, my kids' computers are Windows 7 computers, and I will admit to being really impressed by Windows 7. I think it's a very good upgrade for a change. God only knows why Vista ever hit the market in the first place, but Windows 7 is good, and this is a stripped-down phone version of Windows 7, and for people whose platform this is, Windows is their platform, then it's I think really important that they have that easy transfer from their laptop to their phone and back. So,
and from what I understand too, this plays really well with the Zune software, and there are some people who are very, very fond of their Zunes, and it's anything that kind of breaks up a monopoly I think is a good thing. And Apple and iTunes seem to have such a lock on, the music player, and the iPhone is such a phenomenon that it's nice to have a lot of choice.
I'm going to bring Dan back in here.
Hey, I'm back. I was just thinking. Sorry for that little interlude there, but aren't we a featured podcast in the Zune Marketplace? I think
Digital
Campus is. Yeah, I've received several tweets from people saying that we're a featured podcast in their academic section or something.
Well, maybe that'll really increase our listenership once Windows Phone launches.
I think, Tom, we discussed this probably a year ago, and you said it's going to increase our numbers by tens. I think that was the quote.
But I think with the launch of Windows Phone, which looks like a really nice offering, I think they've done some interesting things with the UI. I think there's this kind of panorama interface where it has various panels on the home screen that extend left and right off the screen, so you can kind of slide the screen to see different parts of applications. It looks pretty slick. You know, and I think, you know, as the enterprise, including campuses, is going to take a pretty hard look at this. And so maybe now that we'll be a featured podcast on the on Windows Phone, hopefully that'll stick. We may increase our numbers by hundreds.
Well, you know what we should do is launch a campaign to get people to, you know, rate us really high and subscribe every, you know, in iTunes and, you know, get us.
Oh yeah, people should really do that.
The iTunes store, yeah.
Don't we need an iTunes or Android app?
Oh Lord.
You know, a digital campus app.
Yeah, right.
You want to start working on that, Mills?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'll do this weekend.
I'll knock it out this weekend.
But I think, Mills, you make an interesting point about Windows 7. I do think that, you know, Windows was on its heels, I think, for a long time. Microsoft was on its heels for an awful long time. It seemed like all the interesting news had been coming out of Google and Apple and Facebook. But I think, you know, with the launch of Windows 7, I get the feeling Microsoft is not as dead as people might have thought. I think Windows Phone looks really good. And I think the other announcement we saw this week was a partnership between Facebook and Bing to make some kind of social search, basically tying search results to your Facebook friends, the things that your Facebook friends have liked, to try to hone the search results that you get from a Bing search to map that onto your social graph and to give you customized search results based on the kinds of things that your friends have been searching for and the kinds of things your friends have liked. It seems to me that's an interesting new direction for both Facebook and Bing, and I think it may be a challenge to Google. Do other people have thoughts on this kind of social search announcement?
You know, I was thinking about these new Microsoft announcements, and boy, they really are trying hard. But I think where it's different now from what they used to be is that they were always able to leverage Windows, right, to kind of force people to, for instance, use a new browser from Microsoft. And they've lost that near monopoly power to kind of leverage the OS to get people to use other stuff. And that, I think, is their biggest problem right now is – I agree that I think this Windows Phone 7 thing, like, it looks pretty cool. I like the UI quite a bit. But is it that much better than Android or iPhone, you know, that it makes me take a second look? Probably not. Is Bing that much better or even as good as Google to make you switch? I just think the problem is that they're coming second. And they used to be able to come second when they had OS power. In other words, I think their, you know, Internet Explorer was a second browser, right? But they made it a 90% of the market browser because they put it into Windows. But you can't, you know, put a phone into Windows. Maybe they're thinking of ways to do that, but they haven't yet. And, you know, and search is another area where it's just, you know, Google has become a verb, and it's just much harder for, even though I think Bing is actually, it's not too bad right now. But it just, you know, things like social search, I don't know. Does your average college student, are they going to switch from Google to Bing because of that? I'm not sure they will.
Yeah, I will agree with you there. I mean, I think it is much harder for Microsoft. I think the difference that I've seen, at least, is that I think Microsoft maybe gets that finally. I think they've been, you know, operating for the past, you know, 5, maybe even 10 years, thinking that they were still the monopoly they were in 1997. And it seems in the last year or two, they've kind of realized that they're in trouble and that they've been at least trying to innovate and move in new directions that recognize that they don't have that kind of lock-in that they used to have. Any further thoughts on Microsoft and these new announcements, Amanda?
Just that, it surprises me that Microsoft tries to innovate as much as it does, given that, I mean, I saw a study recently that Internet Explorer went under 50% worldwide for the first time. You know, that if you look at all browsers worldwide, you know, Internet Explorer for the first time had less than half that market share, but they still do have such a lock on Microsoft Office and on you know, the OS, the Windows OS. And then the other thing that they're really good at is Xbox. You know,
that's right.
A lot of people are really, really good at Xbox. But I think they're doing fine. I'm not worried about them because they make a lot of money on all those. So, you know, you have to innovate or die, I guess, in the tech world. But, I mean, I think if they can keep up in the browser space, if they can keep up in the mobile space, you know, the tablet space is another thing that they need to kind of compete in. And they are working on that. Then I think they're going to be okay, and they're going to be around for a long time.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they didn't buy Yahoo when they were negotiating with them, because the thing that Yahoo's figured out is how to get people to use Yahoo as its homepage, as their homepage. You know, they've got something like 600 million people worldwide who use Yahoo as their homepage. They don't and then use a Google search through their browser, but they like the Yahoo homepage for some reason. So that, I think, it's just surprised me that deal didn't work out. But I do think that the competition's been good for Microsoft. I mean, for just as a small example, they just have gotten better in a lot of things. I was just complimenting Windows 7 before Dan got back, but the satellite imagery that you can get through the Bing mapping system is significantly better than what's available through Google.
Yeah, totally.
Significantly better. Hmm. And which means that they're paying for better satellite imagery from the big providers, like, you know, the gatherers of that imagery, like GeoEye and people like that. And so they, you know, and the interface on it is better. You can actually spin the image on the screen. So I was looking at my house the other day because we're getting ready to have some work done, and the architect, we were looking at it together in Bing, and he was spinning around the house on the screen, and I said, "How'd you do that?" And he said, "Oh, it's easy." So, you know, that's something that, you know, Google has not innovated on.
Yeah, and another of the big, in a similar vein, one of the things that Google is often criticized for, and they've tried and tried again to get right, and they haven't been able to yet, is social. Google doesn't get social. And I think that Microsoft, Amanda, you mentioned the Xbox. The Xbox is a hugely successful social platform through Xbox Live. Not one that I spend a lot of time on, but one that a lot of people spend a lot of time on. And if they can transfer some of that expertise to the phone and to their search engine and maybe to Windows 7, they may be able to make some inroads. Apple actually hasn't been able to master social either. There, we saw the launch of Ping, their social network that's based around iTunes, that has been, as far as I can tell, a kind of a flop. I think Microsoft certainly has some assets. I think they're more than they have been in the last couple of years. Certainly since I think we've been on the air, it's worth watching Microsoft. Well, moving along to our last story, I'm sure a lot of you listening today are probably thinking you should be doing something other than listening to us. I'm sure that your attention
unless you're working
could be
out at the same time.
Right. Well, okay.
I actually took that advice.
Maybe.
I went off and did something else while the podcast was going.
Exactly. So if you have if your attention is divided, Mills, you posted a link for us to talk about for those of us who's having a hard time focusing their attention on the important things of scholarly life, like reading and writing. Something called antisocial.
Yeah, it's I think, you know, it would be okay. So for the fact, if they had the 50-minute version of antisocial, then faculty members could require, who don't want laptops in their classroom, could require it to be installed on all their students' laptops, but it cuts you off from the social networking systems. And so I tried it out. I stayed home on Tuesday to get some writing done. I installed it on my computer, and let me tell you, I got a lot more done because I couldn't check any of these other things that distract me. And so, you know, it's
so
really
this
a response.
It's not just an internet off sort of thing. This doesn't just kill your internet. It's
no.
Specifically
no, it didn't kill my internet. It just it killed me from the distractions, basically. And so it's
so you kill so you install this thing and it kills, you know, it doesn't let you access Facebook. It doesn't let you access Twitter. Is that
exactly?
I didn't realize you were such a Facebook addict, Mills.
I'm not. I'm not, but, you know, I...
Why did you know? What were you turning off?
Well, let's see. I was mostly turning off Facebook, and I pretended that it was cutting off my email, too. And
you
so
see, that's a thing, yeah.
But since I pretended that it cut off my email, then it did.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to cut off Twitter because I'm already cut off.
That's the cheapest software development project ever. You know, like instead of actually building the software, you know,
something,
you build
just pretend
some
that it does
little thing and like pretend. I actually, that's my strategy for my email. I was doing that just this morning. You know, I mean, I actually, if I owe you an email, I'm sorry. There's a couple that, you know I need to respond to, but I'm like, I have to build this spreadsheet. You know, I know it's not very exciting, but I did. And
I mean, it is sort of amazing that there's really a, you know, I think this is a free download, but, there really is a lot of software out there that's designed to, cut us off from all this new technology. I know we've talked about Writeroom and its clones, which is a piece of software which basically just throws up a black screen with green text. It's a writing environment where there's no menu bars, no icons, no flashing, you know, no paperclip jumping up from the bottom of the screen that, you know, is just designed to give you a blank slate on which to write. You know, we've seen that. We've talked about Google. Google has a little Labs plugin that for Gmail that allows you to turn your Gmail off, actually, you know, for a certain amount of time, for 15 minutes or 20 minutes, so that you can't check your email, so that the software actually has built into itself a lock switch, so that you can't be distracted by it. You know, we've seen more and more of this. It really is a growing trend, and I think it speaks to our divided attention. On that note, I think we've divided your attention long enough, our faithful listeners. We'll be back again. Welcome, Amanda. We'll be back, and maybe we'll have Amanda host next time. We'll see. Maybe we'll give her a couple of weeks to...
Yeah, I like this idea.
That
sounds better and better.
Then I can be totally distracted during the podcast.
Well, maybe we'll give Amanda a couple of weeks to break herself into her new world. But we're really happy to have her, and we're really happy to have you listening. And we will see you again in a couple of weeks on another Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
Amanda, could you just say a couple things? Just, I want to see what your level's like.
'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and jimble in the wave. All mimsy were the borogoves and the mome raths outgrabe.
That's what we're going to do this time on Digital Campus, poetry. It's our all poetry episode.
Among my memorized poems are many works by Lewis Carroll. So I think I have most of... Your old father, William, the young man said, and your hair has become very white, and yet you incessantly stand on your head. Do you think at your age that is right?
Wow. Yeah, I don't know much poetry.
I wish I'd memorized anything near that good.
Yeah, seriously.
I know Rock You Like a Hurricane.
Yeah.